unusual and very nice. I've been here for a day and a half and I enjoyed my time very much. And it looks like you're a very, very nice setting here. So,
Tim?
Yes,
Tim.
Thank you very much. I apologize if I be talking with something in my mouth. It's a candy. I had a bad sore throat for the past 2 days, and if it goes dry, it gets problematic to speak. I hope you won't mind that, and this should fit the slides. Excellent. So, the work I'll be talking about today was done in collaboration with one of your own, Anusha. I still have two of your slides in the middle of the presentation. I promised I would remake them, but I never did. The driving force was really my graduate student, James Hamp at Cambridge, who has done really the groundwork for all of this piece of research, and another long-standing collaborator of mine is Roderick Mercier at the Max Planck Institute for Complex Systems in Dresden. What we wanted to do is really to look at critical phenomena, if you want, a critical point, in a somewhat unusual setting. What we have, I will be saying a few buzzwords in the next minute and a half. The scope of the first 15 minutes of the talk will be to put meat to those buzzwords, but just to put a picture to what I will be talking about later. What we looked at is this, as I said, unusual critical point, where we start with a localized spin systems with interactions. It has a phase transition, not surprisingly. What's perhaps surprising is that understanding this phase transition is rather difficult from a point of view of the spins themselves. As a matter of fact, we do not have an understanding of what and why this system has a phase transition until we understand that the spins form actually a vacuum for fractionalized excitations that behave like a gas of point-like particles. And it is actually in the language of these particles that we can make sense of the phase transition as being the critical endpoint in a liquid gas phase diagram, something that you wouldn't expect in a localized spin system at all. And in fact, the type of criticality that you expect there is that of a Coulomb liquid, which comes at odds with the idea of having started with spin system. As a matter of fact, a spin system in an applied field where the last thing you would expect is to have something itinerant to have in there. So really, we have a criticality that is understood or driven, if you want, by emergent degrees of freedom. And so what we wanted to understand is, how do we characterize this? Does it behave as we would expect it? There is a two-step process. In general, we do expect criticality to transcend the microscopic details of a system because of scaling variance. But here we have a two-step process. We start with the localized spin system. We coarse-grain it into a dilute gas of particles. These gas of particles become critical to yet a higher level of coarse-graining and scaling variance. And that criticality should be Coulombic criticality, which is believed to be 3D easing universality class. So can we recover all the exponents? That's what we wanted to do to begin with. And on the side, but not less importantly, all of the physics I'll be talking about has a relevance, direct relevance, we believe, to an experimental setting for some pyrochloroxides. And one of the things that we were particularly interested in is just to do Kibble-Zuber scaling. So rather than looking at typical finite size scaling for critical points, which we also did, but looking at finite time scaling, because these experimental counterparts to the models that I will be discussing have a very unusual property. The spin dynamics in this system is particularly slow. In magnetism, we are used to spin-flip timescales in real materials that are nano picosecond, something very quick. In these systems, for reasons that are still maybe to be fully clarified, spin dynamics seems to be in the millisecond timescale. And all of a sudden, milliseconds sounds appetible from a point of view of studying out-of-equilibrium behavior, because thinking about time-resolved measurements becomes quite a possibility. And for those of you who are familiar with Kibble-Zuber scaling and finite time scaling in general, you will know that there are very few experimental realizations where we can actually check that finite time scaling behaves as we expect it to do in a critical point. Experimental examples are a few and far between, and as a matter of fact, experimental checks of proper scaling functions and collapses are altogether absent. And all of a sudden, this idea about using these topological magnets with slow relaxation timescales we will argue and I'll discuss it towards the end of the talk, opens perhaps a window to do finite time scaling in a context where we can actually compare with experiments quite closely. And that would be very interesting.
I just need you to turn on your microphone. It's a little switch at the top of the pack. Thanks.
So I forgot. Sorry about that. I won't restart, though. Experimental realizations, of course, they are another point that is very important. What we're doing here is a bit of theory, numerical simulations. In the end, we have conclusions. We will want to check them. If and ever we can put all of these, contrasting it to experimental realization, we will see whether our results hold or not, and if there is anything more in the experiments that actually needs to be understood to see if this criticality really is observable as we think it is. The outline of the talk is starting with a bit of context and motivation. As I said, I will explain all the buzzwords that I meant, that I said in the past minute and a half, a bit more maybe. I will discuss what emergent phases are, specifically in the context of spin ice, this interpretation of a correlated spin system as a vacuum plus fractionalized excitations. It is in the context of these fractionalized excitations that we understand the phase diagram as a liquid gas phase diagram of a Coulomb liquid with the critical endpoint that we will go to study. And it's, as I said, it's a bit of a novel setting in terms of criticality because of this two-step level of coarse graining and understanding of the critical point. And here, as I mentioned, we will deploy two tools to study to characterize the critical point. One is the conventional finite size scaling, which confirms, as I anticipate now, 3D easing universality expected for Coulombic criticality. And also the out of equilibrium behavior, Kibble-Zurek finite time scaling, with the specific aim actually at thinking, how can we actually get this in real systems? How do we compare our simulations to experiments, et cetera? And that's what I'm going to conclude on towards the end of the talk. This is a bit of an accordion talk. I can accelerate or slow down in different parts, so do ask questions at any point, and I'll hope I'll gauge my speed accordingly. I don't know. There's definitely a very broad variety of background knowledge on spin ice in the audience, as far as I can see, so help me out with questions about the speed I should go in. So what are emergent phases of matter? How do we put the work we've done into context? We're all familiar with the conventional framework in many body systems, and you have a high temperature or high energy picture of the system that has all the symmetries. As you lower the temperature, interactions can lead to spontaneous symmetry breaking. You can break some of these symmetries and develop ordered phases. All of this was put very nicely into context by, for instance, the Landau-Landau-Ginzburg type field theory that allows to classify phases and phase transitions in terms of which symmetry you break and correspondingly which type of local order parameter appears in the system. And this has a very broad range of applicability and had wonderful successes from liquid solid phases, magnetism, superconductivity, the beautiful theory of superfluidity of Tony Leggett in recent years. However, from the, I would say, 70s maybe, starting with the Kosterlitz-Taubes transition, starting with lattice gauge theory, it was realized that for as broad as this scenario, this understanding of high temperature symmetries that get broken down at low temperature possibly, this generic framework doesn't apply all the time. There are systems that escape this paradigm, systems where the interactions don't quite lead to spontaneous symmetry breaking. They leave the system disordered, even if you lower the temperature. But not trivially disordered, you actually still build correlators, correlations at low temperatures. And these correlations actually give rise to new type of symmetries in the system. So what you have is that as you lower the temperature, rather than breaking one of the symmetries present in the system, you build an effective symmetry into the system. One of the contexts where this became most evident and most studied is certainly the fractional quantum Hall effect. You start with a system that has relatively limited symmetries at high temperatures and at low temperatures. You build correlators between correlations between the degrees of freedom to the point of giving rise to new type of symmetries that typically have a topological nature,
They depend non-trivially on the boundary conditions of your system. They develop edge modes. And hand in hand with this topological property come a completely different nature of excitations over these low temperature phases. Rather than a local order parameter that typically develops domains and domain walls, in this new context topologically, you develop point-like excitations that now behave as new quasi-particles moving in this topological background. And these new quasi-particles have the extraordinary, if you want, ability of fractionalizing the microscopic degrees of freedom presence in your original system. And I will explain some of this in a specific context. The fractional quantum Hall effect, so 2D electron gas, is not the only system where this is observed. Another class of materials that actually exhibit this type of physics within the context of magnetic models and materials are frustrated magnets. Frustration is the idea of the fact that the competition between the interactions does not allow the system to develop conventional order. And the moment you suppress these ordered phases, you end up with the phenomenology that I was mentioning, the possibility of an emergent symmetry at low temperatures, topological phases, and these novel effective degrees of freedom. And all of this I will illustrate in the specific case of the system we studied that goes under the name of SPINICE and has become a little bit of a point of reference for this type of physics in three dimensions. So, as I said, what we worked on is really theoretical work plus simulations. But the beauty of SPINICE is that it's really experimentally inspired. And so I want to introduce it really starting from an experimental touch, even though eventually we will end up with a specific theoretical model that we are studying. And so SPINICE materials, two of the founding materials that people have focused mostly on are dysprosium and holmium titanate, and they have three essential characteristics. The magnetism is from the rare earth ions, dysprosium and holmium, and they form what's known as a pyrochlore lattice, or lattice of corner sharing tetrahedra. The local environment for every magnetic ion forces them to have a very strong easy axis. The largest energy scale forces the spins to behave as easing degrees of freedom. And they are very large spins, so what I will be discussing in this talk is well captured in the classical limit, so statistical StatMech modeling of the system. Although within the same class of materials, you can actually have other members of the family where quantum fluctuations are important, and this is beyond what we will be discussing, but nonetheless something interesting perhaps to look into. They have large magnetic moments. Large spins and large magnetic moments doesn't only mean that the classical limit is the appropriate picture, but also means that all of a sudden exchange interactions are not the dominant ones. They are in the realm of about a Kelvin in terms of strength. For those of you who are familiar with interaction strengths, I mean, in cuprates, you're going to hundreds and thousands of Kelvins in exchange, whereas dipolar interactions are equally strong here at nearest neighbor level, and therefore they cannot be neglected. With these ingredients in mind, the physics actually can be characterized by the following properties. One is that the dipolar interactions long range renormalize or essentially can be resummed to nearest neighbor level, and the nearest neighbor interactions on the pyrochlore lattice are fully frustrated. That means that the system is unable to develop a local an ordered phase with a local order parameter, and maintains an extensively degenerate ground state down to very low temperatures. And this extensive degeneracy can be understood in terms of an emergent gauge symmetry. And if we look at the elementary excitations here, they take the form of defects that are localized on the tetrahedron level, and they are able to fractionalize the elementary degrees of freedom in the system, these spins or dipoles, into separate magnetic charges that are free to move in three dimensions. And therefore, they give rise to this emergent Coulomb liquid description of a gas of charges with Coulomb interactions. And in the next few slides, I will actually explain all of these parts a little bit to put some meat and understanding in these buzzwords about SPINICE. So The first observation about spin ice is trying to understand the ground state. And we have long-range dipolar interactions, which are usually very difficult to model and understand. And there was a lot of debate in the early days of spin ice model and materials to try to understand what type of ground state they lead to. But it turns out that, quite surprisingly, through what came to be known as a phenomenon known as projective equivalence, you can actually resum largely these interactions and reduce them to favoring a local configuration at the tetrahedral level, which is the one where two arrows point in and two arrows point out, and then no further interactions other than quadrupolar corrections, which are very weak. This means that down to very low temperatures, the energy is purely minimized by configurations that obey this ice rule. And if we do the counting for this, we can actually discover that there are an extensively large number of ground states. And this was confirmed experimentally by, for instance, integrating the magnetic component of the heat capacity and showing that the entropy change that results from that integration from high to low temperature is far from recovering the full R log 2 that you would expect for easing spins, but rather is missing a big chunk. And this big chunk is consistent with the estimate of the degeneracy from the ice rules. So we have a system that doesn't order down to low temperature. So how do we understand this phase? It's clearly not ordered, but it's also not trivially disordered. We know that at the local level, we have this hardcore constraint, if you want, if we take it to the extreme, of having everywhere two arrows in, two arrows out. And a particularly useful way of making sense of this is actually to think about the arrows as fluxes, gauge fluxes, and therefore of the ice rules as a conservation law for this flux. As much flux comes into a tetrahedron, as much goes out. And then we can think of developing a field theory. Contrast this, for instance, with a system with local order parameter. You would have thought about looking at the type of symmetry that gets broken, the order parameter you have, and then develop a field theoretic description based on the order parameter. Here, we do not have an order parameter, and so we don't know what's the right coarse graining tool to develop a proper field theoretic description for spin ice. On the other hand, we see that lowest energy condition imposes this conservation law divergenceless, discrete divergenceless condition for these fluxes, and therefore one can argue that the meaningful way of coarse graining the spins is to do so in a way that respects this divergenceless. And so we take these microscopic fluxes, mu I, into a field that has to be divergenceless. And the simplest assumption for a field theory of that type is to think about a free divergenceless field, which we know we can represent as the curl of a vector potential. And if it's a free field, it's just the integral of the absolute value squared of that curl. Of course, at this level is just an assumption. It's the simplest one. The field theory could be much more complicated than that. But in as simple as this is, it is actually quite constraining, because the moment we make this assumption of a free field theory with a divergence as condition, then we can compute the field-field correlators. And they should capture, if the field theory is correct, the long wavelength behavior of the spin-spin correlation function. So we actually make an assumption, but we can go and check and test it. And as I said, it's quite constraining as a prediction, as an assumption, as a prediction, because the correlators in a free divergenceless field, which is the correlators we are used to from magnetostatics, are actually algebraic. So they decay dipolar-wise as 1 over r cubed. And they have a peculiar angular dependence between the direction of the component of the field that we look at and the separation vector between the two points that we are looking at. And if we have a prediction about correlation function between the spins at long wavelength, then we should be able to compute from that the structure factor and compare with Monte Carlo simulations or experiments. And if we take the Fourier transform of this object, what we expect in the reciprocal space, this is a slice along HH0 and 00L in reciprocal space, is that around the Brillouin zone center, we will see, well, the power law behavior as we leave the Brillouin zone center, but more importantly, the cos squared theta dependence in intensity that goes from high to low to high to low, giving rise to what's referred to as a bow tie or pinch point pattern, which is rather unusual And I already showed in the previous slide the theoretical prediction and the experimental observation of these pinch points, which is rather compelling evidence that this free divergence-less field theory is the right way of understanding these systems. Now, we understand the ground state, or this ground state, if we want, sometimes referred to as manifold, ensemble of many configurations. How do we understand elementary excitations about them? We are dealing with Ising spins, so clearly the simplest explanation is a spin reversal. We take two tetrahedra that are in their ground state, we flip the spin between. Both tetrahedra now cost energy because they are no longer in the two-in-two-out state. And if we were to think again of contrasting this with a conventional ferromagnet, once we flip a spin, that would be the precursor to domain nucleation. All of a sudden in the system, it should be cheaper to flip spins near this defect than elsewhere. And then as you flip more spins, you build a domain that costs an energy around the boundary, et cetera, and you build your domain in the ordered phase. In this context, it remains still true that we can flip spins more cheaply around this defect, but this happens in a very different way. So if you zoom out on a slightly bigger configuration, these are all tetrahedra that are in the lower energy state. If we take one of these excited tetrahedra, they have three majority spins, and if we flip one of the majority spins, what happens is that, for instance, if we flip this one, the tetrahedron that is interested here, that was excited, goes back into its ground state, two in, two out, and the neighboring tetrahedron that was in its ground state now becomes excited. Clearly, this is an energy favorable flip, because at this level, or at least at the level of nearest neighbor interactions, we literally transferred the energy costly defect from one place to another in the lattice without any energy cost whatsoever. Now, if we think of including dipolar coupling between these spins, there is actually an energy cost to doing this. But one can demonstrate that this energy cost actually resums to a finite value if we want to separate these defects farther and farther on the lattice. For instance, if we have here the three majority spin, we pick another one, we flip it. Again, we transfer the excitation. And as I said, the energy cost in separating them is finite up to infinite distance. And therefore, the definition is that they are deconfined. So for any temperature, there is a finite probability of finding these two defective tetrahedra farther than any given distance r. This means that even if the elementary excitation in the system that we started with was reversal of a spin, so had a dipolar nature, actually, there is no meaningful way in associating one defective tetrahedron to the other as a pair. They are deconfined, they can be whenever, wherever they want. If you have more than two, you can never know which one was associated with each other as a thermodynamic statement. And therefore, the elementary excitation in the system is actually not a spin reversal, but an individual defective tetrahedron. And they come in two flavors in terms of gauge fluxes, for instance, whether the net gauge flux is going out or in. And the moment we actually think about this arrows not only as gauge fluxes, but as a physical degree of freedom carrying a net magnetic moment, the violation of the divergence-less condition is actually equivalent to having a net magnetic flux out of this tetrahedron and into that one. That means that this actually, what spin ice has accomplished in this process is to separate the two endpoints of a bar magnet into two magnetic charges that are free to move across the lattice. We expect, and there is indeed a Coulomb attraction between them, but other than the Coulomb attraction, these are two magnetic charges that are free to move. They are sources and sinks of a magnetic field H. Of course, they are collective excitations of a material. You cannot take them out, so they are not monopoles in that sense. So to recap, what we have is as a function of temperature, a high temperature paramagnet, a low temperature, we expect eventually that the third law of thermodynamics is not violated and there must be some ordered phase, which is a puzzle on its own that I will not be discussing in terms of out of equilibrium dynamics and how to access it. Yep?
In principle, you can have a quantum field.
Yes. Yes.
It doesn't have to work.
At the very low temperatures, you mean?
Yeah, at low, it doesn't have to order it at lower temperatures in principle, right?
Yes, yeah, true. But you still, yeah, that's fair. So yeah, if quantum fluctuations, so, but even in the level of purely statistical mechanical model with long range dipolar interactions, you don't expect the frustration to be exact. So even without quantum fluctuations, it would order. But if you have quantum fluctuations, they could prevent, and then you end up with a Coulomb liquid, like quantum spin liquid phase. Yes. But for the purpose of what we are going to study, we studied in this work, actually, we have a pretty broad temperature window where we have a progressively more correlated, if you want, spin system represented pictorially here in 2D, where, yep.
The right dot is T, like Q Kelvin, the crossover temperature?
Yes, there is no phase transition in the system as a function of temperature. We have a paramagnet that gradually builds correlations. So more and more tetrahedra become two in, two out. Fewer and fewer have excitations in them. So this is just a crossover. And as correlations build up, the defects become sparser and sparser and becomes more and more tempting to switch the language rather than using this strongly correlated spin system, which is difficult to understand from certainly from an analytical point of view. We could consider that the spins act effectively just as a vacuum for these point-like objects that have Coulomb interactions. So to a zeroth order, we can wipe out the spins altogether and end up with a vacuum and charges. So we are coupled by Coulomb interactions, so a Coulomb liquid. And then one can think of putting back in the effect of the spin background with further and further corrections. Clearly, the spin background weighs the charge configurations, and that gives rise to some entropic interactions. From a point of view of dynamics, the way that the charges can move in the system is strongly coupled to the spin background, because on the one end, the background is changed only by moving these charges. On the other hand, the way that the charges can locally move is dictated by the spin arrangements. Not all possible moves are allowed, even though thermodynamically they can explore the full 3D space. At the microscopic level, locally, there are constraints that give rise to some kinematic blockage and phenomena that are important out of equilibrium. There are also global topological constraints, because moving charges, as I said, changes the spin configurations. And so if you think about a wall of positive charges and you move it across the system from left to right, you fully magnetize the system. So you can immediately see that some of the charge fluctuations that you expect in an electrolyte, for instance, in general, are forbidden in spin ice. You cannot have net volume charge accumulation, because, as I said, the moment you put a wall of positive charges across, the only thing that can follow is a wall of negative charges. Another positive charge can no longer travel in the same direction. And so if you have a volume V, the net accumulation of charge inside it at most is V to the 2/3. So this imposes a very powerful smoothing condition on the possible fluctuation of charges that you have in the system. But anyway, so these are some of the conditions that one has to keep in mind when one goes to the effective description in terms of charges. And I'll come back to that to motivate part of the work that we have done about the critical point. But as I said, at the moment, we don't have a critical point, well, down to here, the ordering, which is not the one we're going to study. We looked at so far only at temperature, and we need one more tunable knob to end up with the phase diagram that I anticipated earlier. Before I get there, because I almost forgot about this slide, why is it useful to change the language from spin to charges? I mean, there are many systems where we can rewrite degrees of freedom in a different manner, and ultimately, it's important and valuable to do so only if it allows us a better understanding or predictive power with respect to the original language or other language we're using. And in this case, it's actually quite powerful, because we go, as I said, from a strongly correlated spin system to a Coulomb liquid description where the charges become sparser and sparser because they are excitations. So we go towards the dilute limit of a Coulomb liquid, and we can draw from that extensive literature and try to backtrack some of those results into prediction and understanding for the physics of spin ice systems. And this goes a long way, not only in understanding correlations, but also, for instance, the heat capacity. The experimental data here are square, open squares represented in a heat capacity function of temperature plot. And if we take typical approaches we have for localized spin systems, such as low temperature expansions, et cetera, some of the best fits we can get are represented by this red curve, which agrees at high temperature but doesn't do a good job at low temperature. And whereas if we switch completely the language and we take face value, the description in terms of a Coulomb liquid, we can actually use results from that literature, for instance, the bi-Huckel approximations, to compute the free energy and obtain the heat capacity, and you obtain the blue curve, which disagrees at high temperatures, where the Coulomb liquid description is no longer sensible, but does an incredibly good job at low temperatures. I agree, Michel, that there are lots of fluctuations in the experimental data here, and I'm representing only one data set. But nonetheless, even with ambiguities on some of the experiments, which is a, this was an internal note, the agreement is remarkably better if we take this effective language rather than the localized spin system. The modeling is not limited to thermodynamic properties, but also to dynamics. And this is seen from a microscopic level if we consider that actually these monopoles or these defects act as facilitators for the spin dynamics. Remember that if we want to flip a spin generically in your system, it creates two defects. That's an activated process that costs energy. At low temperature, it takes time to do that. On the other hand, if you have an isolated defect, it hops around at nearly zero energy cost. And by hopping around, it modifies the underlying spin configuration, and therefore it is a facilitator for a response mechanism of the system. And you can do a proper hydrodynamic theory of these charges moving in the background of spins. Rishkin did a treatment in 2005. But if you want just a poor man scaling, would suggest that the typical response time of a system being facilitated by these excitations will be the characteristic spin flip time scale tau zero divided by the density. The more you have of these excitations, the faster the system is able to respond, say, into an applied magnetic field. This means that at very low temperatures, the time scale becomes large because the density of the facilitator becomes exponentially small. They are energy costly excitations, and so we expect an exponential slowdown in the system at low temperature, and this is actually comparing quite well with experiments. It was well known that you have some zero feel cool splitting in the magnetization as a function of temperature. The system becomes too slow to follow, to respond to a magnetic field below a certain temperature. More quantitatively, you can look at the spin susceptibility as a function of frequency and obtain the typical response time of the system. And then you plot this response time experimentally as a function of temperature, you get these black crosses. At high temperature, we violate the crystal field. This is some physics that I'm not discussing here. What we're interested in here is the very fast upturn at low temperatures. And what you see is that it's observed in experiment, and this very simple law that neglects all interactions but just accounts for the fact that monopoles are facilitators of the dynamics gives you this red curve. There is a disagreement with experiment if we zoom in, of course, but it captures the leading order of the upturn, and you get a much better agreement, the blue dots here, if you then add interactions, but at this point you do Monte Carlo simulations to obtain the time scale.
So in the plot on the right, so there's comparison between experimentally extracted reaction time with the simple prediction from the theory.
Yeah.
So tau zero would be the intrinsic time scale associated with spin flipping.
Exactly.
Which in principle is also a function of temperature.
In principle, but you have to tell me why and how.
Because it's basically the tunneling from a spin up state to a spin down state, which by itself, it has also to overcome some barrier due to the crystal field effect.
Yes.
So there is an intrinsic quantum tunneling. And on top of that, there's also thermo-assisted, function-assisted tunneling.
Yes. Usually, I have a short and a long answer to that. I'll go in midway. Usually, you expect at low temperatures to be quantum tunneling dominated, and that should be temperature independent. Having said that, everybody assumed that, the spin glass literature assumes that, and so on and so forth. And then I tried to see if you can actually prove it. You take a two-level system, you couple it to a bath, you do Lindblad approximation, and you don't get a regime where spin flip is quantum tunneling dominated. So that is the part that we can discuss separately. But the general assumption is that if you have a spin that has two states, any particle that has two states and a large barrier, at high temperatures, the two states are populated, and you have thermal system hopping, flipping. At low temperatures, it's going to be quantum tunneling due to some quantum perturbations, and that should be a temperature-independent process, therefore a temperature-independent timescale tau zero. There are experiments in spin ice, not shown here, that suggest tau zero actually does or should depend on temperature, but that is not well understood at the moment. Remind me to talk later, because that's actually an interesting point. But OK, so what we get out of this is that the monopole picture allows to understand quite well this upturn, surprisingly well considering the simplicity of this argument. But we also learn two more things. One is the size of tau zero, whether it's exactly temperature independent or not. Nonetheless, we read it out from experiments. It's essentially the value of this plateau, should we call it. And it's in the ballpark of milliseconds. So that's the slow time scale that I was mentioning earlier. The other thing is that in order to do better than this very simple Poorman scaling that I explained here, what one can do is Monte Carlo simulations of these particles hopping around on the lattice, assuming tau zero is your Monte Carlo times unit time. And in general, Monte Carlo, as all of you probably know, is not a time evolver. It's a trick to compute thermodynamic quantities. So treating Monte Carlo time as time is an abuse, generally speaking. In this system, it works well. It seems that this idea of single spin flip at a fixed time scale plus Boltzmann factors entering in your Metropolis algorithm does a good job at capturing the dynamics of these real materials. Yep.
So this activated behavior basically tells you the gap of this energy gap of this monopole.
Yeah.
So can I just apply like a fit model the energy scale from QoS temperature to see if they really match?
Oh yeah.
They match.
So I mean, if you want, the match is seen here, because from fitting the heat capacity, you get the parameters here are Hamiltonian, bipolar constant, and nearest neighbor coupling. From that and the mapping to a monopole theory, you end up with a bare monopole cost of about 4.35 Kelvin. And that is literally this red curve, no fitting parameter. So it's not a steeper value that would make you a better agreement. The better agreement is really from Coulomb interactions. But that's, so yeah, you get sensible numbers, actually.
So this time tau is measured by like mu SR?
So what you do is you could measure it. No, mu SR wouldn't, because mu SR is limited time scale window wise from 1 to 10 microseconds. So milliseconds is outside the ability of mu SR. But what you do is you measure the frequency-dependent AC susceptibility. And if you take the imaginary part of that frequency susceptibility, AC susceptibility as a function of different temperatures, sorry, is barely visible. We go from that I can't even read, actually. From 0.8 Kelvin to roughly 2 Kelvin, each color corresponds to a different temperature as a function of frequency. The peak position in the imaginary part of the AC susceptibility corresponds to the characteristic time scale of the system. And so you read off the frequency at this peak, and the inverse of that frequency is the time scale that we have here. Sorry, decided to go to sleep.
So the tau zero that is found experimentally, do you remember, is it like in the millisecond type time?
Yes.
But you know, if you just took like, you know, guess what it might be, like say the Q device temperature, like the 2 Kelvin temperature that you have for crossover, which is the bare time energy scale, divided by the time constant, you'd get something like 10 minus 11 second or something like that.
Yeah.
So there's a magnitude time scale that is problematic, right?
Yes.
No, we don't. So why this is milliseconds? I would personally, I would say we don't understand fully. It's read out of experiments, so we're not assuming it, but we don't understand. I think understanding the single ion dynamics in these systems will require some careful modeling of the crystal field, and it's an interesting problem. I don't think it's fully fleshed out at the moment yet. Yep.
Is it because the spin is so large, so you kind of need to go, like, you cannot just tell it?
Qualitatively, yes. But then I would like to see a calculation that shows it. You do have a complicated object. So you have a spin that is large. It has two states where points one way or another, many levels in between because the spin is actually 15 halves or 8. But then in the Hamiltonian, you have no matrix element that couples the two. They are coupled step 3 in the spin ladder process. And understanding what quantum perturbation could give you a quantum tunneling between the two ground states is not immediately obvious. And how you get a timescale of a millisecond. I mean, obviously, the larger the spin, the slower. But then if you want to obtain it quantitatively, I would like to see it done. Because every time that one tries to actually set it up, as I said, I tried to set it up with a trivial idea of a two-level system and Lindblad, and it doesn't work. And then three-level system and Lindblad, and still gives us some funny result. So it's just an open problem. But the answer will be necessarily, I think, what you just said. In the end, it's just going to be a confirmation that, yes, large spin with a barrier in between leads to these slow timescales. Okay, so just actually speeding up a little bit. We need, as I said, one more knob to end up with a phase diagram. And the one that we considered here is actually an external applied field along the global 111 direction. So if we take the pyrochlor lattice, the field is directed along this diagonal, if you want, in this cubic unit cell. And if we turn it around a little bit and we focus on two tetrahedra, the field that we're applying is actually now vertical with respect to this system. And we see that it will have a different overlap between different spin states because the easy axis of these spins is canted with respect to the field, whereas this one is parallel. So if we crank up the field, the first effect that it will have is to polarize the spins that are most aligned with the spin direction. But then if we do that, we realize quickly that the energy and the Zeeman energy, the interaction energy and Zeeman energy are competing because the interaction energy wants two in, two out. So this is the best you can do in terms of Zeeman energy if the interaction is dominant. And you have one spin that necessarily points against the field. And if you keep cranking up the field, eventually you end up with the Zeeman energy winning over interaction, and this spin will point the other way around. And that favors having a negative, if you want, monopole in this tetrahedron and a positive one in the other one. Translated in this effective emergent charge picture, the magnetic field at high values acts as a staggered chemical potential. It favors localizing negative monopoles on this tetrahedral sublattice and positive monopoles on the other one. And so if we now have these two knobs, we have temperature and a field in the 111 direction, we can look at the phase diagram. And we can start doing that by thinking of the effective picture where we are tuning chemical potential and temperature in a system of Coulomb interacting charges in three dimensions. And this is the typical liquid gas phase diagram that we would expect. It has a low temperature phase where you go from low monopole density for low chemical potential, high monopole density for high chemical potential via a strong first order transition represented by this line. As you increase the temperature, the magnitude of the first order step becomes smaller and smaller. And eventually, it closes at a critical endpoint. And it becomes a smooth crossover at high temperature. And this was measured experimentally in spin ice. Now what we are applying is the magnetic field as a function of temperature. And they observed this strong first order behavior with a critical endpoint and a continuous crossover. And when they observed it, it was actually before a proper understanding in terms of magnetic monopoles was available and was quoted in the paper as an unprecedented behavior in a localized spin system. We really don't know how to understand this phase diagram unless we actually understand it as emerging from this Coulomb liquid description.
And that's what's exciting about it, in the sense that the criticality here is driven really by the Coulomb charges, and Moeca simulations are shown here in blue. Okay, sorry. This I said already, so I'm actually going to just skip on that slide. So we wanted to focus on this critical point and trying to understand how do we study scaling properties. The first thing we did is finite size scaling. Just to recap, we have a liquid gas behavior, so the type of criticality is Coulombic, which was established in recent years of being in the 3D easing universality class. And so we have schematically a phase diagram of a field, temperature, this line of first order transition, a critical endpoint. The first thing we would actually have to realize is that we have a little bit of a misnomer in language. We call something as interaction, field, and temperature, but in fact, none of them are the fields and parameters that we would expect for the critical theory. There is a well-known phenomenon at critical endpoints, which is, goes under the name of field mixing, because what we call magnetization and energy are not the magnetization and energy of the critical endpoint. If anything, you can understand it easily because this first order line is actually slanted with respect to the physical temperature axis, and you expect the easing temperature axis to be parallel, the analytic continuation of this line, if you want, which is tilted with respect to T. So we first would have to actually do some mixing of the fields to obtain what are the easing temperature and field easing field parameters that go in the critical theory. There is a recipe to do this, and given that I've actually taken a lot of time in the introduction, and this is all technicality from several decades ago, is not all that important. Thing is, we need to be careful about what we call energy and magnetization. That's the only point that I wanted to raise. But there is a proper way of understanding how they mix and obtaining the mixing parameters. Once that's done, we can just proceed now with finite size scaling as we would expect. And so we can look at, for instance, Binder cumulants to look at the find the location of the phase transition in the T and H plane, and then measure, for instance, the magnetic susceptibility for three different system sizes. We are simulating the full dipolar system, not the effective monopole model, which means that with long-range dipolar interactions, we have to use Ewald summation, and we are constrained in 3D to relatively small systems. We cannot do really large systems as one would for a 3D easing model. Nonetheless, with L equals 6, 8, and 10, we find a reasonably convincing collapse. With a fitting parameter, we use the, well, it's a typical collapse, so we use the scaling exponents as fitting parameters, and the values we obtain are in good agreement with 3D easing criticality. I should put out a caveat here. In 3D, with the unfortunate, we have the unfortunate accident that 3D easing and 3D XY exponents are incredibly near, close to one another. There isn't, we don't have enough accuracy to tell the difference from the exponents, but empirically, people have been using the joint probability distribution of fluctuations in magnetization and energy to distinguish between the two. So these right panels are from the literature. If you plot the probability fluctuations of the energy fluctuation horizontal, vertically and magnetization horizontally, easing should look like this, and XY should look like this. This is what we find. So it's highly suggestive that easing is the right class, as we would expect, but we thought we would do the check nonetheless. More importantly, however, the really interesting bit that we wanted to go to was actually Kibble-Zurek of finite time scaling. And before showing the result, let me step back one moment and explain how this works for those of you who may not be familiar with it. In general, if we have a critical point and some parameter delta that controls the distance from the critical point, for instance, the reduced temperature, it's well known you have a correlation length xi that grows as you approach the critical point and diverges as a power law controlled by some well-defined scaling exponent. As the correlation length grows in your system, you expect that also the relaxation time scale in the system grows because it takes longer and longer for the system to relax on longer timescales. And that is controlled by the dynamical exponent z, so the correlation time scales as xi to the power z. So now if instead of doing thermodynamics, you think of actually doing a sweep where you change the value of your parameter delta at a constant rate, say 1 over tau, there is a point in your sweep where the time that remains to reach the critical point becomes shorter than the time that the system would take to respond, to equilibrate at that value of the parameter. This is an easy intersect. We can just plot the correlation time that diverges and the absolute value of t line, and the crossing is the point that I just mentioned. This crossing is typically called the Kibble-Zurek time scale, and given that we know the functional form of all of the curves involved, you can easily revert it back, and if it's a linear sweep at constant rate 1 over tau, this Kibble-Zurek time is some power of tau, where the power, the exponent is controlled by these universal scaling exponents nu and z. So if we think about doing actually this sweep, there is an interesting approximation that allows to make some prediction of what might happen in the system that's due to Kibble and later on elaborated by Zurek, which is, if you want, is the adiabatic frozen approximation. One can make a coarse grain, a very coarse statement of saying that the system is in equilibrium up to this point, and then beyond this point, the system remains completely frozen. It's obviously an approximation. It's not true. It will evolve, but the divergence of this correlation time is so quick that it becomes a good approximation to say it's completely frozen until you cross the critical point, and then you reach the other side when things become quick again. In this adiabatic frozen approximation, then one can actually think of developing a scaling theory, because if we think that the system develops a correlation only up to this time tk, and then it remains frozen there, well, having a time scale to the critical point where you stopped developing correlations means that you have a typical correlation length in your system, which is tk to the power 1 over z. And as you ramp with different speeds, you change the location of this freezing time, which means that you change the length scale up to which you develop correlations in your system. And this is exactly what you do with finite size scaling. You allow your system to get closer to a critical point, but by having a system of a size L, its correlation length grows only up to L. And here you do the same by taking a very large system, but changing the speed at which you reach the critical point, and at different speeds, you end up freezing out your system at different length scales. And so as a function of this LK, you should be able to apply finite size scaling, which means that it's a finite time scaling as a function of tau. This is, of course, very, very briefly put. There is a proper scaling theory that one can develop more accurately and less hand-wavingly. And two of the references I mentioned are here, and Anusha can explain it way better than I can. But there is essentially, if you have a variable as a function of space and time during your ramp at constant rate tau, then there is an appropriate scaling limit where this observable reduces to a universal scaling function of distances measured in units of the Kibble-Zurek length, time measured in units of Kibble-Zurek time, and a rescaling factor in the front, which bears the scaling dimension delta of your most relevant operator appearing in the observable. This is way more general than we need, because what we did is actually a very, very simple scaling of the magnetization. So we have no space dependence, because we take the global magnetization of the system, and its scaling dimension is well known. And so what we do is that we measure the magnetization as a function of time during one of these sweeps at constant tau. And what we expect is that in the proper scaling limit, this should be a universal scaling function of t over Kibble-Zurek time, rescaled by 1 over the Kibble-Zurek length to the power delta, where I remind you that both Kibble-Zurek's length and time are just powers of the ramp rate or inverse ramp rate tau with exponent controlled by just scaling exponents of your critical point.
What about the length, are you assuming across? I mean, this is classical system, right? So
yes.
Some classical dynamics that you are kind of putting in by...
Yes, so in this case, we are assuming brute force that Monte Carlo dynamics, single spin flip, is a meaningful time dynamics. If we wanted then to compare back to experiment, we have to refer to the slide I mentioned earlier, where it seems that this is a good thing to do.
I think there is some... kind of like universal Hoffman-Hoffenberg theory of these things, right?
Not quite, not generically.
I guess there are different classes.
There are different classes of dynamics, but okay, so from this point of view, yes. So you, from a point of view of models, theoretical models, yes, you have different classes of dynamics.
And does it agree? Does one of those classes agree with what you find in Monte Carlo, say for that?
Why would you want to know which class it is? Oh, with the value that we find for Z. Oh, I haven't gone to that yet, but yes. They don't predict the Z for the specific microscopic value. It makes a difference. So it's not as simple as identifying a class, and therefore it's a value of Z, if I'm not mistaken. Within the same class, you can actually have different values of Z. Yeah.
Yes, it's called model in the Heinberg-Hartmann scheme,
yeah,
which you have the Fizier non-conservable parameter.
But then Z doesn't fix Z, does it?
Well, I think Z is 2 minus... it scales with the leading correction in epsilon is the same as the one for the analytic dimension.
Okay.
So I think that is close to 2.
But you can, within model A, you can get larger than 2 exponents, Z. So.
Well, it depends on the spatial dimension.
Yeah.
But just a comment about that. So that's right about model A, but here there's no clear order parameter. Like, although the microscopic dynamics are spin flip, that's not the order parameter. So it's not clear how to write down an effective Hornberg Hartmann equation and claim that that's the right order.
But presumably it's same as liquid gas, any liquid gas.
No, but that's an emergent degrees. So that's the thing, right? The spin flip dynamics is being done with microscopic spins, but the emergent picture in terms of monopoles is what has the Coulomb with criticality. So either one would like to write a dynamics effectively for the monopoles, and if that falls in model A for the density order parameter, then you would conclude that this is... I'm just saying it's two different things. There's the spin flips, which is microscopic, and then there's the criticality as understood by emergent models.
Well, but the system doesn't need to understand anything. Mm-hmm. The system undergoes its own criticality, right? If it's one
experiment. Yeah, but to interpret that it's a model A of some order parameter, one would think of the dynamics of the emergent models. That's the...
Well, you don't have to think about... it's first order transition ending and then second order critical point, right? So it doesn't really matter. There is just...
No, but the Hornberg-Hartmann equations are for the order parameter field.
So in this case, it's an Ising-order parameter, right?
In terms of the magnetic monopole.
Yeah, so there's one point that I forgot to say. I mean, there's a little bit of one has to be attention. You start with Ising degrees of freedom, you end up with Ising criticality, and I should have pointed out they are not connected.
No, I understand that.
There's a magnetic field that breaks the first Ising symmetry, and the second Ising symmetry is emergent from the monopoles.
But I think if you take any classical system with a phase diagram that you showed with, you know, first order plot ending at a second order critical endpoint, you know just that has to be Ising critical endpoint. You can forget about the monopoles.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So,
yeah. But the statement was identifying the dynamics we are implementing in the Monte Carlo, right?
Well, why should it be Ising? Could be, I don't know,
you have two.
Well, I think it took Michael Fisher 15 years to figure out that it remains Ising despite the long-range Coulomb interaction. But I don't think we can resolve it in 5 minutes here.
But I mean, given the 15 years, we can say
it's you're worrying about dipole.
Yeah.
You're worrying about the long-range dipole. Yeah.
Okay.
But still easing all the parameter, just with one, you know, possibly with longer range.
I mean, I think, as Michel pointed out, Coulomb liquids, real Coulomb liquids, it wasn't trivial to demonstrate that it was easing criticality. But I take it as settled now. And then if we think that this is properly a Coulomb liquid, then the expectation is easing criticality, fine. That doesn't, however, identify a class in the Hoyenberg picture in the sense of just the type of criticality you have.
Well, I guess you have to have no conservation laws, right, then?
Yeah.
But you don't have any conservation laws here. There's no sense.
I think there is.
No, but I guess you should let him go.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe we can continue later. Okay. I was arguing more on the microscopic dynamics than the conservation laws themselves, but yeah. Okay, let's maybe talk about And then, so then, yeah. Okay, so that's what we do. And in principle, in Monte Carlo simulations, it's fairly straightforward to do a field sweep. We go from high field to low field, back to high field. So we sweep back and forth in a way that we go across the critical point. We do so at a constant rate where we change the field. And we plot magnetization as a function of field. The critical point is somewhere here in between. These are different sweep rates. So tau is the time scale for the whole overall sweep. So in field, smaller tau means that you go faster. That means that you open a larger hysteresis because the system tries to develop this long correlation length, and it takes time, so it falls out of equilibrium more prominently if you're going too quickly. It's convenient, however, for scaling purposes to plot these curves as the upper one, so the first part minus the second part, and plot it as a function of time to the critical point. So those same data points are plotted here. And then we can apply the scaling theory that we had before, trying to collapse all of these curves with the scaling assumption that came out of the earlier slide of finite size scaling, and that's the collapse we obtain. Here I'm plotting two different system sizes, L equal 8 and L equal 10, for six different sweep rates, each of them. And the collapse is reasonably good. We didn't assume any scaling parameters. We obtained this one. So we find a good scaling behavior over two decades with the parameters. Nu is 0.42, plus or minus 0.01, which is consistent with easing criticality. The z exponent to come to a conundrum, if you want, we get 1.85 plus or minus 0.05. And here we have a bit of an issue. It turns out that the z exponent for 3D easing model has been obtained with some kind of numerical simulations, not exceedingly precise, if you want, back in 1991, and no one else had looked at it since. And that back then, they quoted it as consistent with z equal 2. Talking to some people nowadays who have been working in related contexts, they would believe that z equal 2 is probably not correct. It should be larger than 2. That is sufficiently at odds with the value we measure to raise a flag. And of course, we don't know. Ultimately, we haven't tried so to re-simulate the 3D easing model. We don't know what's going on, strictly speaking, here. One possibility is that our system sizes are still too small for this to have converged nicely enough. And in fact, it would be larger if we could simulate larger system sizes or not. Or maybe there is some physics in this. Remember that we have monopoles that have local kinematic constraints, etc. It could be that they alter slightly the value of z in the relaxation near the critical point. And this would be actually interesting, but it's not not understood at this point. A different way of plotting, in some sense, the same type of behavior is to take, rather than the curves themselves, the area inside the hysteresis loop, and then plot it as a function of inverse sweep rate. From the exponents that we had earlier in the previous slide, the behavior you expect shifted for visualization purposes is this straight line. And what the area scaling is able to show for different system sizes is that we get a good scaling regime in the intermediate range. If we go too fast, we have a high-speed cutoff. And this is expected because Monte Carlo has a minimal time, a unit time. If you change all of your field in one unit time, obviously the system is unable to respond altogether. It seems that below 10 Monte Carlo steps for the whole process, it doesn't really make sense to look. And then more physically, we have a low-speed cutoff. If we go too slowly, the correlation length in the system builds up to system size, and we go from finite time scaling to finite size scaling. There is a way to treat them both together, but we haven't done it. So in our case, what we see is that the behavior peels off from what you would expect at criticality because of this interference of finite size system. And the larger the system, the more scaling we are able to obtain. So as I promised, and this is really the end, I'm sorry I'm going a bit over time. One of the driving factors that we wanted to that brought us to study this system is really the fact that we have a unique opportunity with the dynamics of these materials being so slow to being able to resolve time-dependent measurements. And this was shown, for instance, in AC susceptibility, etc. We get good agreement between Monte Carlo and experiments, and they can be resolved within timescales that are accessible with AC susceptibility, milliseconds to seconds. And so this is very tempting from a point of view of Kibble-Zurek or finite time scaling, because verifications of Kibble-Zurek scaling are very, very few and far between. There are some in colloids, some in some solid state materials. But typically, people are able to look at defect density frozen in at that adiabatic to frozen transition and how they scale with the speed. But proper tests of the scaling of dynamical response functions are altogether missing. And what do we have here is that the observed dynamical rate in holmium dysprosium titanate is of the order of a kilohertz, this millisecond time scale, and it's modeled quite well from separate comparison with Monte Carlo simulations. So if we believe this, we can actually try to translate our results into physical parameters for these materials. And then what we have been sweeping is fields at a speed of 0.03 to 0.7 Tesla per second. 0.7 is a bit quick, but they are not altogether outside the experimentally accessible range. The fields are swept between 0.5 and 1 Tesla, and we have been keeping the system somewhere around half a Kelvin. Experimentally, that transition is known to be a little bit lower temperature, but again, not unarrivable. And this would suggest that Kibble-Zurek scaling of the sort that we have been describing may be just about accessible in existing state-of-the-art experiments in these spin-ice materials. As a matter of fact, back in 2010, there was a setup, which is no longer working, unfortunately, where field sweeps were measured. So when you measure magnetization as a function of field sweep, and the parameters that they are used in those simulations, in those experiments, were actually very close to the ones available here. So we are hoping that it's within range of being able to test what we have predicted. Finite time scaling is certainly more achievable in sweeping a field than doing finite size scaling or anything like that in an experimental context. And that would be really nice to see if we can find an agreement and if we can find a new playground to really measure Kibble-Zurek physics experimentally. So this is just to summarize. We studied this critical scaling in and out of equilibrium in an unusual context of a 3D spin system, which is develops a topological emergent phase at low temperatures. And the critical behavior we have studied can be understood as driven by emergent excitations forming Coulomb liquid and exhibiting liquid gas behavior. Finite size scaling identifies the expected 3D easing universality and out of equilibrium, which is consistent with that and gives evidence of this Kibble-Zurek scaling of dynamical response function, perhaps with this conundrum on the Z exponent value that we obtain. And the parameters, as I mentioned, are within existing field sweep capabilities in experimental context. So we hope that someone will be able to prove us right or wrong and take it from there. Thank you very much.
What's the spin-spin, like real spin-spin correlation function at the 3D icing critical point? How does it look?
We haven't looked, actually. So that's an interesting question. So you're just thinking, if you plot the dynamic structure factor, say the Fourier transform or spin-spin correlation at the critical point.
Right.
I don't know if, well, you have seen it. They must have been measured, but I actually haven't. I don't have it off the top of my head, what it looks like.
Theoretically, I guess you expect that the local spin will naturally mix with the with this easing order parameter for the phase transition. So there is no reason why you shouldn't see it critical. No.
So you think you would see in the spin-spin correlation critical behavior? Is it obvious?
Well,
so what goes critical is the correlator between the occupancy variable of the monopoles.
Does it have the same symmetry? the spin transform all and the time reversal. And the power density also have the same transformation property. It shouldn't mix.
They can mix, but you expect that you would be able to see the contribution from the occupancy from the spin-spin correlators.
As long as there's no symmetry prohibiting mixing, right? Maybe the coefficients, for some reason can be numerically small, but otherwise.
Yeah. No, no.
For instance, in general, it's argued that the density molecule somehow is manifested in the width of the pinch points. So I thought maybe somehow, there should be related somehow.
Yes, but then, so we are at a critical point where the density of monopoles is actually finite. So the pinch points will be broadened.
So would it be some sort of sudden broadening of, as it go across the pinch point?
You're talking about the zero temperature, sorry, the low temperature first order or the critical endpoint? The critical endpoint, I'm not sure what it looks like.
Uh-huh.
So it will be highly disordered. Plus a critical component that gets picked up by the overlap of the order parameter, easing order parameter with the spin correlators, with the spin operator energy. Yeah. How visible it is experimentally, I don't know.
You showed that the Slobensky paper from 2010, and they showed that if you're sweeping faster than 10 millitesla per minute, you start getting these thermal runaway processes.
Yep.
So there's even like, possible to sweep like 700 millitesla per second.
Okay, so that's a good point. Good. So there are heating issues. I have two answers to that, I suppose. One is that the way that they coupled to a refrigerator in this type of systems was through the typical support with a silver sample holder, and then you cool the silver. I think the group in Germany, I'm sorry, I forgot the authors, but I can dig them out. They have done acoustic ultrasound measurements showing the same type of heating phenomena, and they disappear if you literally dunk your sample into liquid helium. So it seems that if you improve your thermal contact in the sample, you can get rid of these heating processes. So first side of the answer is, it may be that the spikes that they observe, which are interesting on their own, you can remove them experimentally, which is what you would want to do by improving your thermal contact in the system. The second answer is perhaps more important. They were seeing those jumps, but they were at 0.2 Kelvin. 0.3, 0.4, they started not seeing them much anymore, and they were sweeping at relatively fast rates. What limits the low temperature, the lowest rate here, which is still quite high, is system size. Remember that the low sweep, low speed cutoff is dictated by the fact that the correlation length reaches system size. And this is inherent to our simulations where the cell is really small. Experimentally, you're not going to have that cutoff coming in as easily. And therefore, we expect that you would be able to sweep quite a bit more slowly and still observe the behavior, with one, of course, caveat. At some point, the hysteresis does get so small that within experimental accuracy, you may not be able to resolve it. And then you have another problem. That is a little bit more difficult to guess a priori.
Just to add to that, the slower you can sweep, the better the CCI. So if you can't do the fastest sweep, it's OK. The faster sweeps is where you follow the equilibrium further from the critical point and more unlikely to be seen universally because it's resistant. So you're not even trying to go there.
I see.
The fact, yeah.
But if you sweep too slow, then if you sweep too slow, the this approximation is not going to be very good. This frozen approximation.
Oh no, there's always, because the
So the adiabatic frozen approximation would be perfect if this line was vertical. So the slower you sweep, the closer this point is to the critical point, the more vertical this takes off, so the better it gets. But of course, then the narrow range gets really narrow, and so you need, with analytic resolution, you can always zoom out here. Experimentally, you may not be able to see that anymore.
Is it just a way to motivate measure the scaling? Maybe the scaling is kind of more the kind of the final scaling forms that you wrote. Maybe they are more general than the adiabatic process approximation. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's a better position to answer that.
Yes. In fact, they show features in what you would call the frozen regime and so on.
So you can do you go so beyond, yeah. But then you have to assume that the system is still coarsening inside here, right? So you have to develop a modeling that takes into account the fact that your correlation is still building here a little bit.
Yeah. And these things that you measure do show features on the scale of what you would have called frozen. So indeed, it's a way to motivate it, but the general scaling form allows for whatever.
I see.
So experimentally, what's the are there concerns about impurities in terms of stuffing and in terms of trying to expose that in an experiment?
Naively, I would say impurities maybe not. I mean, there are lots of open questions, and I think that some of the bigger ones are how good is the dynamical description? How well this single time scale adapts? Because if there is a little bit of temperature dependence or field dependence on the spin flip time scale, does the applied field modify your spin flip rate, etc.? These are questions that I'm worried about. Yes, so you're assuming they're small. So the disorder, I don't know, because so long as you observe a critical endpoint, I would have expected that disorder means that it doesn't affect the criticality, and so it would be wiped out by the
long high risk cracking, and you know, right? That, for the thermodynamics, the high risk cracking would clearly tell you that it would affect the critical structure of the critical endpoint, right?
The
high risk criterion, because
could,
alpha is positive for 3D icing. That's right.
Yes. Yeah. So it is stable to disorder.
It's stable to disorder.
No, because nu is 2/3 and it's 0.67. I think it's just stable. 3D
icing
is
stable,
to disorder.
Up to a finite value of disorder, then it dies.
Yeah. It's very close. It's 2/3, which is 0.66, is the nu.
Well, it's more than 2/3. That's the point.
Yeah, but that's the stability criteria. So if nu is greater than equal to 2 over D, the clean critical point is stable to disorder.
I don't think so.
3D easing is pretty stable.
But maybe it's actually moot, right? Because alpha is so small that maybe if disorder is kind of not very weak, then actually you might not see scaling at all. And unless you go to like extremely large systems, I mean, extremely weak disorder or extremely large system sizes. Right, I mean, if alpha is very small, that's...
I don't know what that means, dimensionless quantity. Alpha is 0.1, I think, for 3D icing.
Is it 0.1 or like more like 0.01?
I don't know that is. I mean, I guess what he's saying is that even if it's unstable, there's a crossover lens, like it's flowing from one critical point to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, that's right, you can understand that. But I do believe
that
the icing is actually stable.
I thought it was, but I mean, maybe I'm... I have the paper, yeah.
So are there more questions? If no, let's thank Claudio for a wonderful talk.